Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, good evening, and welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thanks for coming out, supporting local independent stores. We certainly appreciate it. Tonight, we're very pleased to welcome New York Times best-selling author Roger Stone. Stone served as senior campaign aide to Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and Senator Bob Dole. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. Currently, Stone writes for The Daily Caller and Fox Opinion Online. Tonight, he joins us to discuss and sign his newest book, Nixon's Secrets. Please join me in welcoming Roger Stone.
Great. Thank you very much for being here. You know, history is a sled of lies agreed upon. I am one who spent 40 years in the corroded rectum of the two-party system, someone who worked for three presidents and had direct access to three presidents of the United States. And despite my Western attire, don't kid yourself, I was a Washington insider for 40 years. I preferred English tailoring martinis in the better watering holes in Washington, D.C. And I have seen the underbelly of American politics, and therefore I have to tell you that at a certain point, it became very clear to me that the odds were overwhelmingly, if the U.S. government told you something, it was overwhelmingly possible or even likely that that was a lie. The government didn't tell us the truth about Castro in Cuba. They didn't tell us about the truth about the Bay of Pigs invasion. They didn't tell us the truth about John Kennedy's assassination. They didn't tell us the truth about Watergate or Vietnam. Didn't tell us the truth about the Central Intelligence Agency running drugs in Asia. They didn't tell us the truth about the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. They don't tell us the truth. And therefore, there is, I don't like the word conspiracy, but there is a cone of silence in the mainstream media that tells us a narrative history that in many times is bogus, is not the truth. Now, I wrote a book last November called The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, in which I made a compelling case using motive, means and opportunity, fingerprint evidence, eyewitness evidence, and deep Texas politics to prove that Lyndon Johnson had more to gain from the murder of John Kennedy than anyone else, and in fact, he was the linchpin of a plot, we never use the word conspiracy, that did involve the Central Intelligence Agency, angry about Kennedy's botching of the Bay of Pigs, in their view, angry about the Cuban Missile Crisis and the fact that we, the Americans, actually secretly withdrew American missiles from Turkey and Italy, which the American people weren't told about for 40 years. So that story you've been told about the Cuban Missile Crisis, how brave, dashing John Kennedy faced the Russians down and they blinked. Folks, that's bunk. We made a Boston-style political deal. Nikita Khrushchev took the Kennedy boys to the cleaners. We had no on-site inspections. We have no proof that their missiles ever left, but they were allowed to verify that our missiles left Italy and Turkey, and that was classified for 40 years. Organized crime, they had a seat at the table. You see, Ambassador Joseph Kennedy got $1 million from the Chicago mob for John Kennedy's election, and in return, he agreed not to have the Kennedy administration pursue the deportation of Carlos Marcello and Santo Traficante, two of the biggest gangsters of the time. Well, you know the story. Old Joe is incapacitated with a stroke. Bobby went after the mob after a deal had been made, and they had a stake in John Kennedy's murder also. And then there's Big Texas Oil and their oil depletion allowance. Lyndon Johnson was their chief water carrier in Washington. But John Kennedy already announced he was doing away with the oil depletion allowance, and it would cost the right-wing Texas oil men hundreds of millions of dollars. So, anyway, I was not reviewed in the New York Times or the Washington Post, but the book became a New York Times bestseller anyway. Bryan Cranston, who starred in Breaking Bad, who's also on the Broadway show All the Way with LBJ, told the New York Times, the book he studied to try to get down Johnson's character was my book. Make no mistake, Lyndon Johnson was a crude, vicious, mentally unbalanced, sadistic, epically greedy, drunk, an abusive individual, whose own aide said behind his back, likened him to Hitler, Stalin, and pointed out his mental instability. The airbrushed version put forward by the Lyndon Baines Johnson taxpayer-financed library is a falsehood. Lyndon Johnson stole his first election to the U.S. Senate. He stole the 1960 election in Texas for the Kennedy-Johnson ticket. And Johnson's right-hand man, Bobby Baker, the Secretary of the U.S. Senate, on the day of John Kennedy's inauguration, 1961, a very cold day, according to U.S. Senate sworn testimony and Justice Department testimony, said John Kennedy will not live out his term and he will die a violent death. So my book on Richard Nixon is in many ways a sequel, because it is impossible to look at the politics of the 50s and 60s and 70s and not recognize that four men, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Baines Johnson, Richard Milhouse Nixon, and Hubert Horatio Humphrey all wanted to be president at the same time. And three of the four of them became president. My book is in some ways a biography of Richard Nixon, but it is not a love letter to Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon is the most compelling and kind of interesting figure of the 20th century. First of all, he is durable. He is on the political scene for 40 years. He resurrects his career no less than three times. So my story, my book is the story of the rise and fall and rise and fall and rise and final resurrection of Richard Milhouse Nixon. Talk about resurrection. Jesus Christ only pulled that off once. Nixon is nothing if not resilient, but he's a paradox. He is brilliant, but obtuse. He is bold, but hesitant. He has enormous confidence in his own abilities, but he is paranoid. He is endlessly manipulative. He is calculating and smart. He is above all disciplined. This is a Nixon you don't know. Nixon can't read music, but he can read the saxophone. He can play the saxophone, the clarinet, the piano, the violin, and the accordion. And he's actually quite good at all of them. He has an intimate knowledge of wine and a terrific wine palate. He has, in his post-presidential years, one of the finest wine cellars in the eastern United States. He's a near vegetarian who carefully watches his diet. He exercises an hour and a half a day. He is extraordinarily focused. To understand Richard Nixon, one needs to understand the 1960 election. That's the election in which he very narrowly is edged out of the White House by John F. Kennedy. And the story that you've been told about that election, most likely by Theodore H. White's book, The Making of the President, which was a very important book because it changed the whole way that political presidential politics was covered by journalists. White was an idolizer of the Kennedys. They were sophisticated, charming, dashing, good-looking, intellectual. And good old Richard Nixon, he was square, boring, middle-class, middle-class values. He was middle America. He was yesterday. Kennedy was tomorrow. Well, the truth of that race is far more complex. First of all, in the back of this book, you see an appendix of every poll taken from the end of 1959 to the election of 1960, and you'll see it is never a runaway race. It's always within 2 or 3 points. In 1958, the Republicans have the most ignominious defeat since 1928. They lose more governorships, more congressmen, more senators, more state legislators. The party is at its lowest ebb going into the 1960 election. Nixon has the superior stature. He's 8 years as vice president of the United States, and he has some high points. His debate with Khrushchev, in which he very cleverly sticks his finger in Khrushchev's face just in time for the AP reporter to flash it around the world, telling him, no, capitalism is superior to communism and we will bury you, in essence. He goes to Caracas and his motorcade is stoned by communist-led mobs. He is literally completely covered in spit from an angry mob. They come within minutes of smashing in the windows and lynching he and his wife. And when a Secret Service agent draws his gun, Nixon says, put that away. So he has superior stature to John Kennedy. And then he makes a series of truly enormous mistakes. First of all, he pledges to visit all 50 states. Now, the reason he does that is because the Kennedy-Johnson ticket has an advantage over the Nixon-Lodge ticket in 1960, because the Kennedy-Johnson ticket could have it both ways on civil rights. John Kennedy can run as an advocate of civil rights with his running mate, arch segregationist Lyndon Johnson, the man who opposed and killed every piece of civil rights legislation. And in the 1957 bill, which liberals like to point to as his crowning achievement, he drops a poison pill that says if you're accused under the law, you'll be tried before a state, not federal jury. State meaning all white. John, the only reason Lyndon Johnson embraces civil rights when he's president is to avoid a challenge at the 1964 Democratic Convention from Robert Kennedy. If Johnson is such a great lover of civil rights, why do all of the civil rights activists oppose his selection as vice president by John F. Kennedy? In fact, Johnson blackmails Kennedy to get his way on the ticket. John Kennedy already selected Missouri Senator Stuart Symington. He'd already offered him the job and he had accepted. Poor Symington's in his room drafting his acceptance speech. When Lyndon Johnson shows up at John Kennedy's room with Sam Rayburn, he wants to meet with the senator alone, doesn't want Bobby Kennedy there. Then he shows Jack Kennedy a portfolio of photos of Kennedy naked with women, courtesy of J. Edgar Hoover, and says, you can either put me on the ticket or I can give this portfolio to Dick Nixon. This is how Lyndon Johnson becomes vice president. Now, the fact that that Johnson is a segregationist ends up holding the solid South in a very close election, and therefore Nixon can't decide. Is he going to pursue African-American votes in the Northeast, the big states like Michigan, Ohio, California, New York, Pennsylvania, or is he going to try to invade the Deep South for the first time? He's met with record crowds in Atlanta. He can't decide which way to go, North or South, so in the end he goes neither. And he makes a stupid pledge to visit all 50 states, meaning he's spending time in places like Alaska and Vermont and Wyoming that he has locked up. Meanwhile, John Kennedy stays focused on the Big Ten. Then he has a terrible stroke of bad luck. He agrees to a series of debates. We can argue that that is in itself an enormous mistake. He's better known than Kennedy. He has more stature. Kennedy is elevated just by appearing on the same stage. But then, 2 weeks before the debates, Nixon bumps his knee on a car door and it becomes infected. He's hospitalized in Walter Reed Hospital. He's there 2 weeks after Labor Day. If you look at the polls, it's the only time John Kennedy pulls out to a lead. Nixon comes roaring out of the hospital, still on antibiotics, still running a fever, against his doctor's order. He hits five rallies on his way in five different states on the way to Chicago. He arrives in Chicago exhausted, 15 pounds underweight. When he shows up for the lighting check, he wears a light gray suit, and they say his complexion matched his suit. John Kennedy gets to Chicago early, spends the day on the roof with two hookers, getting a suntan. Kennedy understands that it is style and appearance that will matter in the debate. Nixon believes it'll be based on substance. Those who hear the debate on radio say that Nixon has prevailed. Those who see it on TV overwhelmingly say that it's an enormous Kennedy victory. They go to the lighting check, which is kind of like the weigh-in in a prize fight. And the CBS makeup man comes to Senator Kennedy. He says, Senator Kennedy, will you be requiring makeup? No, Kennedy says, no makeup for me. Nixon, of course, hears this. Mr. Vice President, will you be requiring makeup, he says. No, Nixon says, no makeup for me. Whereupon John Kennedy goes to his dressing room where his private makeup man flown in from New York makes him up. Theodore White said he looked like a bronze god. Richard Nixon writes in his own memoirs, I'd never seen Kennedy looking so fit. The other thing we don't know, John Kennedy has an injection of methamphetamine in the throat 1 hour before the event because John Kennedy is a methamphetamine addict. John Kennedy is being treated by Dr. Max Jacobson. Kennedy's other doctors want Jacobson thrown out. They think he's a quack. They want to know what's in the injections. Kennedy is addicted to methamphetamine, a proprietary potion put together by Dr. Feelgood. Ironically, among Dr. Feelgood, Dr. Jacobson's patients is Frank Sinatra, Leonard Bernstein, some of the most noted artists and actors, politicians. Frank Sinatra even recommends his treatments to Vice President Spiro Agnew. Spiro is high half the time. So in any event, the debate is a disaster. Nixon's advisors beg him to have makeup. He refuses. So he puts on a product called Beard Stick, which is meant to cover your 5 o'clock shadow. The problem with that is under the television lights, his makeup begins to run. It's so bad that Nixon's own mother calls his personal secretary, Rosemary Woods, immediately after the debate and says, "Is Richard unwell?" Mayor Daley, watching on TV with his cronies, the head of the Chicago Democratic machine, he turns to a crony and says, "Nixon's not even dead yet, and they've embalmed him already." But here's what they don't tell you. There wasn't one debate. There were four. And while some historians will tell you that the debate audience for debates two and three was much smaller, which is correct, the debate audience for debate number four was every bit as large as debate number one. And it was the foreign policy debate. And by all critics' measure, it was the debate in which Nixon did best. Nixon also hoarded his money for the last 30 days. He knew Joe Kennedy and his bootlegging fortune meant that the Kennedys' funding was unlimited. But he hoarded his money for the last 30 days, and then he unloaded. And therefore, in the closing days, Nixon outspent Kennedy on radio and television. And then finally, Dwight Eisenhower comes off the bench, enormously popular. He goes to New York, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Los Angeles. And he laces into Kennedy. Calls him Little Boy Blue, says he's unqualified to be president of the United States. He draws enormous crowds. Nixon knows that his own polling shows that he has pulled ahead in the close. He's made up for those enormous errors in the beginning to pull into a slight lead. Kennedy's television's been on for months. It's stale. It's old. Everybody's seen it. Nixon's coming on in the close. That's why he gets to Los Angeles content knowing that he has won this race. And folks, he did win the race. The presidency is stolen from Richard Nixon. Not just in Chicago, although there's enormous detail in my book about that, where more people voted per Kennedy in some precincts than were registered to vote, a mathematical impossibility. And of course, the deal that Joe Kennedy made with Giancana and the boys in the mob is there's voter intimidation going on in Chicago. You're told how to vote. No one dares show up and vote wrong. But the real voter theft, the more stunning voter theft is in Texas, where Lyndon Baines Johnson, the champion vote stealer of all time, is in charge of the count. So what does a ballot look like in Texas? I'll tell you. It's a paper ballot. There are no machines. And all the candidates are listed. The Republicans, Nixon and Lodge, the Democrats, Kennedy and Johnson, the Prohibition Party candidate, the local independent candidate, the vegetarians. There's nine candidates on the ballot. In order to vote, a voter is supposed to cross off the names of those they are not for and leave untouched the names of they are for. So in the counties controlled by Lyndon Johnson, if a voter circled Nixon and Lodge, that vote is disallowed. And because Texas has no recount law in 1960, those ballots are burned within an hour of the counting. Lyndon Johnson leaves no evidence of his crimes. Now, we know that 46,000 Nixon Lodge ballots were thrown out in Dallas County alone, 56,000. But the Kennedy-Johnson ticket only carries Texas by 46,000. So when you say, "Well, Stone, you work for Nixon, he was paranoid." You know what? You'd be paranoid, too, if the presidency was stolen from you by a millionaire gangster and his lightweight son. Folks, John Kennedy didn't write Profiles in Courage. He didn't even read it. John Kennedy was eloquent. He didn't write his speeches. When he read them, it was the first time he read them. Richard Nixon wrote his own words his entire career. At least the first draft of them and the last draft of them. So one can understand the resentment that sows the seeds of Watergate. Nixon practices, without question, the politics of resentment. And in the end, the politics of resentment destroy him. But the great tragedy of Richard Nixon is that in Watergate, in the ashes of Watergate, we have completely obscured his accomplishments, and they are many. He ended the Kennedy-Johnson war in Vietnam. Now, liberals like to say John Kennedy was on the verge of withdrawing us from Vietnam. Not according to Robert Kennedy in an oral history right after his murder. Not according to the documents. I remain to be persuaded of that. But while Nixon does actively step up the bombing, he uses it as a cover to withdraw all of our troops. By the time he leaves office, all of our men are back from Vietnam, men and women. He opens the door to China, circumventing the Central Intelligence Agency and the State Department and the Defense Department, where he knows that the hardliners will oppose his peace initiatives. And then he uses the new relationship with China to scare the crap out of the Soviets, who suddenly have an interest in arms control reductions. We have two significant arms control agreements with the Soviets that make this world safer and save Americans hundreds of millions, today billions of dollars. He desegregates the public schools without violence or bloodshed. He gives us the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the original Environmental Protection Agency before it became the behemoth that it is today. He gives us our first actual environmental protection in this country. Now, he makes egregious mistakes. He ends the war in Vietnam. He also ends the 18-year-old draft. He gives us the 18-year-old vote. Most importantly, he saves Israel from complete annihilation in the 1973 war. At Yom Kippur, the Syrians and the Egyptians mount a surprise attack on Israel. Israel's caught with their pants down, shall we say. And their back is against the wall. They appeal to Washington for help. Kissinger's against it. It would just provoke the Russians, he says. The State Department, they're against it. Don't get involved, they tell Nixon. Nixon orders the military airlift of $121 million worth of military supplies, twice what the Israelis asked for. And when 2 days later he learns that the airlift has not begun, he personally calls the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and chews his ass. That's the tape the Washington Post doesn't want to play for you. Everything that can fly, he says. I want everything we have that can fly. Now, if you listen to the White House tapes, Nixon says repugnant things about Jews. But he also saves Israel. Again, the paradox, the contradiction of Richard Nixon. In any event, we now come to the matter of Watergate. I think it is very important to recognize that the hardliners at the Pentagon, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Joint Chiefs, military intelligence, they think in the election of Nixon they're getting an unreconstructed Cold Warrior. They're getting the ultimate hardliner. They're shocked that he wants to get us out of Vietnam. They are shocked that he opens a relationship with the Chinese behind their back. And they're particularly upset about the arms control agreements with the Soviets. As early as 1969, the military begins spying on Richard Nixon in his own White House. A naval yeoman named Radford begins copying secret documents out of desks, files, burn bags, even Henry Kissinger's briefcase. And they go directly to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Thomas Moorer, a rabid anti-communist and an extreme right-winger. But before they get to the Admiral Moorer, they make a quick stop at the desk of General Alexander Haig, deputy to Henry Kissinger. Haig is really the bad actor of Watergate because Haig ultimately becomes Nixon's chief of staff. And his real loyalty is not to Nixon. His loyalty is to the what would eventually we would call the neocons. They try, actually, as I reveal in this book for the first time, to assassinate Nixon twice in Miami. And both times the plots fall apart for the same reason that they participated in the assassination of John Kennedy, because they want to end his peace policies. They like endless war. And in fact, once Nixon leaves office and Ford becomes president, Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld cut the knees of Secretary of State Henry Kissinger off. Kissinger has the title, but he no longer has the power, and shortly he resigns. I'm convinced that there were a number of things going on in Watergate at the same time. One of the most important ones to recognize is that the Central Intelligence Agency learns about the Watergate break-in, which is the brainchild of John Dean, facilitated by Nixon aide Jeb Magruder and implemented by the famous G. Gordon Liddy. Now, I was a little late getting here because I had to go upstairs. John Dean's new book is out contemporaneous with mine, and I had to go move it to the fiction section where it belongs. This book is a cover-up. Mr. Dean has airbrushed himself out of the narrative of Watergate. He says that if you want to read about his role in Watergate, read his book, Blind Ambition. But when questioned about Blind Ambition under oath and confronted about the discrepancies between his book, Blind Ambition, and his sworn testimony, he says he didn't write Blind Ambition. First, he blamed it on Taylor Branch, his ghostwriter. Then he blamed it on Alice Mayhew, his editor. In fact, he says in that interview, under oath, I didn't even read it. He says that this book is based on 362 new transcripts that no one has seen, that he had transcribed. Okay, let's see them. Oh, he says, no, they're mine. They're secret. Well, his friend Stanley Cutler, the famous historian who brought the lawsuit to release the Nixon tapes, he got caught red-handed taking two conversations, two tapes, reversing the order, conflating them to make Dean look better. Caught red-handed. Why should we believe Mr. Dean? Here's what I do know. He completely truncates or omits his conversations with Nixon of March 13th, 16th, 17th, and 20th, preferring to focus on his famous cancer on the presidency. If you'll listen to those tapes, you'll hear John Dean manipulating Nixon into the cover-up so he can cover John Dean's crimes. John Dean is the case officer for the Watergate break-in. How could he forget to say that he's the one who destroyed the contents of Watergate burglar E. Howard Hunt's safe? How could he forget to say that he was the one who dangled executive clemency in front of Watergate burglar James McCord? How could he forget to say these things? Here's the truth about Watergate. John Dean is the man who planned, pushed, and covered up the Watergate, largely because he was interested in the Democratic National Committee's use of a call girl ring that they were using for assignations with prostitutes for high-level Democrats who were coming to town. And Dean was specifically interested in those records because his wife had an association with that call girl ring. Now, there's a new book out by Phil Stanford called White House Call Girl, which further bolsters what I just told you with more and more documents. Mr. Dean has been living a lie for 40 years. 15 years ago, when this was first written, he filed a lawsuit. That lawsuit, he keeps saying, was settled. It was not settled. It was withdrawn. Why is his wife's testimony, why are parts of her testimony sealed? Why are all the documents sealed? I'll tell you why, folks. She's a hooker. That's why. And I confronted him in this. At the Texas Book Festival. You can see it online. You can go to YouTube. It says, I think it's Roger Stone smacks down John Dean for on C-SPAN. Take a look. He won't answer these questions. He says that he'll sue me. Here I am. Truth is the ultimate defense. I only wish Mr. Dean would make good on his threat. And then finally, the true story of Watergate will unravel. Why would the Nixon's men want to break in when they were 19 points ahead of McGovern on their way to a 49-state sweep? There is no good political reason. Here's the one thing Dean does achieve in his book. Nixon never knows who broke into the Watergate. He doesn't know who gave the order. He keeps asking, and nobody will tell him the truth. Not Bob Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, his top aides. Not John Mitchell, his best friend and attorney general. Not Chuck Colson, his hatchet man. Nobody, not certainly not John Dean. John Dean learns that the White House is receiving transcripts of the Watergate bugs 2 days after the break-in in June of 1972, and he lies about this to Nixon and says that there's no White House involvement for 9 months straight. It is not until the 17th that he finally tells Nixon, oh, you've got a problem. Why? Well, because the Senate Watergate Committee is now trying to subpoena Mr. Dean, and he realizes his crimes are about to be exposed. And therefore, he wants Nixon to assert executive privilege to stop his testimony, because he does not want to go to jail for his own crimes. And then there is the fiction of Bob Woodward and all the president's men. We ought to move that to the fiction section, too, sadly. Woodward and Bernstein and the mainstream media narrative of Watergate is a grotesque distortion of historical truth. There is no Deep Throat. Deep Throat is a confection. He is a literary device because Woodward and Bernstein are receiving illegal grand jury testimony. The grand jury is leaking. That's a crime. Just last week, Newsweek reported that among the papers of the producer of the movie All the President's Men, Alan Pakula, they found further evidence that there was no Deep Throat and that the grand jury was leaking. Mark Felt, the guy who comes forward and says he's Deep Throat, he's not Deep Throat. He's probably a source, not a very good one, because by the time the Watergate thing unfolds, he's already been kicked out of the FBI and he's no longer in the flow of information. But because Ben Bradley, who I think most of you saw died just the other day, said in an interview there was no Deep Throat, that there was nobody moving flower pots, meeting in garages, that none of that ever really happened. Mr. Felt is a convenient device for Mr. Woodward. Mr. Woodward has suppressed his own central intelligence and intelligence community background. He has suppressed the fact that he was a military briefer for Alexander Haig. He says he didn't meet Haig till 1973. That's a lie. So that narrative is the convenient narrative, but it is not the truth about Watergate. Let me finish by saying that some of you may know that I have on my back a tattoo of Richard Nixon about the size of a grapefruit. Floats between my shoulder blades. And it is not an ideological statement. It's not even a political statement. What it is a daily reminder that in life, when things don't go your way, when you suffer defeats and disappointments and setbacks, when things look bleak for you, when you're discouraged, you have an obligation to get yourself up off the ground, dust yourself off, and get back in the game. That is the story of Richard Nixon. It is a story of persistence. It's a story of resilience. It's a story of tenacity. It's a story of drive. It's a Greek tragedy because he's both very great and very flawed. But it is time for a historical revisit to Richard Nixon because, as President Bill Clinton himself said at his funeral, let the days of judging Richard Nixon on anything other than his entire record be passed. Nixon himself writes, "One cannot appreciate the majesty of the highest mountain until one has been in the deepest valley." And then most famously, "A man is not finished when he is defeated. He is only finished when he quits." Thank you very much. I would be more than happy to take any questions about either of my books or about politics in general in that period. It is a great pleasure to be here. I'm delighted that the folks at Tattered Cover Bookstore had us. I'm very pleased that everybody came out tonight, and I am open to your questions. Yes, sir. Yeah, I think what you may be referring to is a story that was repeated by Anthony Summers, who's an investigative journalist, who claims that a lawyer in Southern California claims that in the 60s, when Nixon was after he lost the 1960 election and after he lost the 1962 election, that he punched his wife, that he hit his wife. It has never been documented. The two Nixon daughters put out a statement vehemently denying it and challenging Summers to provide further proof other than the word of a man who's been dead for 40 years. So I doubt it. I spent a lot of time with the Nixons. I had the privilege of working for Nixon in his post-election days, although I met him when I was 19 years old. I was the chairman of the Connecticut Youth for Nixon. As a volunteer, I parlayed that into a Whitehurst internship. I met Jeb Stuart Magruder, and I so completely brown-nosed him that I got a job at the committee to reelect the president as the youngest member of the staff. Now, in those days, I was way too junior to have any interaction with the president, although I did get to shake his hand when he visited the campaign headquarters. From there, I went to work for Ronald Reagan. Worked in his successful 1976 campaign, his 1980 campaign, and then ran the Northeastern states yet again for his reelection. It was in that role that I got to know Nixon, who had a voracious appetite for political intelligence, and I, of course, had a lot of political intelligence, polling, rumor, field reports, and so on. I was assigned by President Reagan's campaign to conduct a series of briefings for President Nixon on the campaign, and we became very good friends. And then I subsequently joined him doing political chores and errors, running messages, taking soundings, passing memos, and so on. So I had occasion to be with the Nixons on Christmas for at least 3 years, and all I saw in their relationship was enormous tenderness. If you go to my book, there's an entire chapter on Pat. Pat is not some plastic arm piece. Pat is Nixon's backbone. At every juncture in his campaign, when he is troubled, when things look bleak, when he, just before the famous Checkers speech, if you are familiar with the Checkers speech, let me expound on that. 1952, Nixon is running for vice president. His rise is meteoric. He doesn't go to the House until 1946, and just 6 years later, he's chosen by Dwight Eisenhower as vice president. Now, the truth is that a clique of Eastern Republican leaders saw him as the perfect balance for Eisenhower. He had a reputation for anti-communism that was developed in his epic fight with Alger Hiss, who Nixon said was a communist spy. By the way, Alger Hiss was a communist spy and a traitor. But the liberal intelligentsia of 1946-47 thought that that was absurd, that he went to Harvard. He was a close friend of Adlai Stevenson and Franklin Roosevelt. He was an aide to Harry Truman. He couldn't possibly be a spy. And of course, we learned after the Soviet Union fell and we had full access to the KGB records, he was indeed a traitor to this country. In any event, after Nixon was selected, the New York Post came up with a story, in those days very left-wing, owned by a woman named Dorothy Schiff, that said that Nixon had a secret fund put together by a bunch of rich California businessmen that was augmenting his lifestyle. That drumbeat really grew, and there was enormous pressure on Nixon to withdraw from the ticket, which would have ended his political career before it began. So Murray Schottner, who I write quite a bit about in my book, his canny senior mentor, kind of Gray Eminence, said, "Dick, there's only one way to handle this. You got to go on TV." Nixon gets the Republican National Committee to pay for 1 hour of time. He goes to the El Capitan Theater in Los Angeles without script, just working on the basis of some notes he's taken, and he gives the speech of a lifetime, which basically denies the charges and claims famously that there is one gift I have accepted and I'm not returning it. It's a dog, a Cocker Spaniel, that a man from Texas sent my daughters, and no matter what they say about it, we're going to keep it. Well, the speech is a great success. But minutes before he's about to go on camera, he falters, and he says to his wife, "I don't think I can do this." And she says, "Yes, you can." She's there at every key point of his life. She hates politics. She hates what it's done to the family. She knows that Robert Kennedy wiretapped Nixon in the 1960 campaign, wiretapped his hotel room. She knows that John Kennedy, who keeps talking about he's a family man and his family image, is a shameless womanizer. She knows that the Kennedys have broken into Nixon's accountant's office in Los Angeles to steal his financial records. She knows they have broken into his psychiatrist's office in New York to steal his medical records. She knows all this. I thought it was Nixon who played dirty. There's no dirtier SOB than Robert Kennedy, according to Nixon's memoirs. He was a ruthless operator who'd do anything for power. So I think that my book has an important reappraisal of Pat Nixon, and I think it's a chapter you will enjoy. Another question? Yes, sir.
By connecting all the dots and creating this rather diabolical picture of
yes.
How the government was operating, do you have a fear for your own safety?
I don't. Yes, I'm sorry. The question was whether writing about these cataclysmic events, I fear for my own safety. Because these events are far enough in the past, I don't. However, when my book publishes on the Clintons early next year, I will start wearing a bulletproof vest to my signings. Because there are crimes that Bill and Hillary Clinton have engaged in that you don't know about yet that are so horrific, they will shock the American people. No, not Whitewater, not Monica Lewinsky, not consensual sex, something more vile. And I think something that disqualifies Mrs. Clinton from the presidency. So you have that book to look forward to. I've got to go finish it after. This is the last appearance on 21 cities that I have done to talk about my books. And I have eaten my way across America. And it has been a great pleasure. Another question. Yes, sir.
Extend the Vietnam War for political purposes in your mind?
No, but first of all, the question was about Henry Kissinger and whether he and Nixon extended the war. First of all, I think it is important to understand Henry Kissinger. Kissinger is the greatest operator of all time. In 1968, he is on the payroll of Governor Nelson Rockefeller providing foreign policy advice. Rockefeller is Nixon's great rival. Kissinger derides Nixon as a moron. He is also a paid consultant to the Johnson State Department working on the Paris peace talks or the peace process. At the same time, he's writing secret memos to Hubert Humphrey telling him how he can skewer Nixon on foreign policy. Kissinger's trying to get a foot in every place. He learns as a State Department consultant that Johnson is going to pull a bombing halt 5 days before the election. He also knows that the North Vietnamese and the National Liberation Front have agreed to nothing. They're not. They never said they would come to the table. So Johnson's bombing halt is unilateral. And in Kissinger's view, it puts our men on the ground on some danger without any bombing, you know, without any bomber cover. So Kissinger also knows that Nixon hates him. So he passes the word through William F. Buckley, who's the only guy he can think of that he has in common with Nixon as a friend. This is how Kissinger gets his way into the Nixon entourage. There is no question that Nixon passes the word to the South Vietnamese that they're getting screwed and urges them not to come to the table, but it's not, he doesn't need to tell them because they already know. Bat Buchanan says in his new book, Comeback, that he just rejects that. I'm sorry, Nixon definitely did it. He couldn't help himself. So he said the word through Anna Chennault, the glamorous dragon lady widow of General Claire Chennault. She lives in the Watergate. She's a very prominent Washington hostess. She's also the mistress of Senator John Tower, among others. I mean, she's no Pamela Harriman or Joan Braden, but she's gotten around, as they say. Anyway, she passes the word to the South Vietnamese, on whom she's on intimate terms, and of course, the war falls apart. There's an immediate assessment done on the Vietnam War as soon as Nixon becomes president, but sadly, it's written by the Pentagon and those guys, and they want to go in bigger. Nixon concludes that that's not possible. I think he steps up the air war dramatically, but he also really withdraws our troops on a timetable that is twice the speed of what Melvin Laird and the Pentagon wants. He knows this is done, and he has a two-part plan. We get out, and we prop up the South Vietnamese and see if they can hack it. Well, the second part of his plan is never realized because as soon as he leaves office, the Congress pulls the support from out of the Vietnamese. Now, I'm not arguing that they would have survived. We don't know, but there was no chance they would survive. So I don't think they purposely prolonged the war. Nixon would never have been impeached. All he had to do was withdraw the troops the first week, and he would be a liberal hero today. We would be lionizing him. It would have been the easier course, as he always liked to say. So he does get us out, but at some political expense to himself and to the country. But I don't think he purposely. Liberals like to say, "Oh well, the scuttling the peace talks prolonged the war, cost us lives." There were no peace talks. The war would not have ended in 1968. The bombing halt was a phony. It was a political maneuver by Johnson wrapped up in national security. He didn't have a deal. The Soviet ambassador writes in his memoirs, "I told President Johnson the North Vietnamese will never come to the table. They don't want peace." And he insisted on the bombing halt anyway. So it's a long answer to a short question. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Since
I think he recognized that he could not win. My question is, why did Johnson run for re-election in 1968? Well, first of all, as I indicated, I think he flipped on civil rights. That was his get-out-of-jail-free pass for the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was very important because Lady Bird and Lyndon had millions of dollars in their not-so-blind trust in Halliburton and Brown and Root and Bell Helicopter. I document in this book that Sikorsky Helicopter in Connecticut and Command Helicopter in New York had multi-million dollar contracts, which they had bid on and won, and which had been inked to provide helicopters for the Vietnam War. On November 25th, Monday, Johnson was president. They were canceled, and those contracts went over to Bell Helicopter, where Lady Bird Johnson is among the largest shareholders. Yes, sir. On the
assassination of Diem?
Nixon.
I read that the CIA ignored Kennedy's
want that to happen. But Nixon blamed Kennedy years later, and that was Nixon sent a team of guys in to try and kill the blame, like 10 years after Kennedy's assassination. Nixon tried to send a team of guys in to prove that Kennedy was responsible for the assassination.
Yeah.
They didn't
find anything. Yeah, I don't buy it.
They didn't find anything.
I understand. Well, here's the problem, and that is, first of all, I think John Kennedy, the CIA operates with a wink and a nod. Henry Cabot Lodge is our ambassador to Vietnam, and his brother John Lodge, who's interviewed in the book, basically said Nixon, Kennedy knew about the assassination of Diem, but there was no proof. There was no documents, and no one's ever been able to prove it. So it's an opinion. Howard Hunt, the Watergate burglar, when Dean gets into his safe, when they find out he has a safe at the White House, John Dean, the White House counsel, gets the safe opened by the GSA, and in it are a bunch of cables, which are forgeries that are designed to blame Kennedy for the murder of Diem. And they're amateurish at best. So the intelligence guys can look at them and say they're phony. Diem was a Catholic. Kennedy was a Catholic. It's not clear whether he ordered his death. Some argue that he was aware of it. At the same time, it is important to understand that in 1958, the Central Intelligence Agency and the Mafia get together in a Nixon-approved plan to assassinate Castro. Now, the reason for that is the Central Intelligence Agency assets on the ground in Castro, in Cuba, have all been expelled, so they have no intelligence on the ground. They want to kill Castro, but they need to know his daily routine, his daily route. Where does he eat? Who are his girlfriends? Where does he buy his cigars? They want to whack him. And the mob, of course, has the casino hotel still in the ground, some of them being allowed to operate by Castro, others not. And therefore, they have men on the ground. Nixon, as vice president, heads a task force on Cuba, and he red lights an effort by Robert Mayhew, former FBI agent, to reach out to Johnny Roselli, mobster, and see if the mob will help the Central Intelligence Agency kill Castro. There's a precedent for this. The mafia has worked closely with U.S. intelligence against the Nazis and against the communists, because if we don't have free enterprise, the mob can't operate either. In any event, Lamar Waldron has written a book in which he claims that the Watergate break-in, the purpose of the break-in, was to prove that Mayhew had given Larry O'Brien, the Democratic National Chairman, proof of the Nixon-approved Kennedy CIA mafia plots. I review it in my book. I reject it for a number of reasons. There's another theory that they broke into the Watergate to find evidence of loans that the industrialist Howard Hughes, recently played by Leo DiCaprio in the movies, gave to Nixon's family in the late 50s. Well, those loans became public in the 1960 campaign and the 1962 campaign, deeply embarrassing to Nixon. But they were old news by 1972. So I don't think that is the purpose of Watergate, although I think it is fair to say that of the six men who break into the Watergate, four of them are on the ground on Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963, and those same four are there at the Bay of Pigs. And those same four are involved in the Operation 40, a plan to kill Castro, the famous mafia CIA plan. Isn't that coincidental? I mean, when I believe there are multiple shooters in Dallas. I believe that Malcolm Mack Wallace, who works for Lyndon Johnson, a convicted murderer, leaves his fingerprint on the cardboard boxes in the so-called crow's nest or the sniper's nest at the Texas School Book Depository. He's on the payroll of D.H. Byrd, the man who owns the Texas School Book Depository building. He's a longtime gunman for Lyndon Johnson, but I believe there are other shooters. I believe there is a shooter on the grassy knoll. And we know that immediately after the shooting of Kennedy, a Dallas policeman drives his motorcycle up on the knoll, and he's stopped by a man with a Secret Service credential and says, "This area is sealed." So he leaves. He later identifies that man as one of the Watergate burglars, Bernard Barker. So these are not coincidences. All these events have the same cast of characters. There's a thread of history here that connects the Bay of Pigs, the Kennedy assassination, Watergate, and the pardon. Next question. Yes, sir.
Castro assassination plot, Operation 40, did that cross into anything with, I'm mind that you sat Alan Dulles and the Lansdale on?
There's also, as you know, after the Bay of Pigs, there's Northwoods, which is even more outrageous. There is no question that the Kennedy assassinations are the Castro assassinations attempts, and it fails. It actually morphs into what becomes the Bay of Pigs. The Bay of Pigs was supposed to operate on two tiers. At the same time we were invading, we were supposed to be trying to bump off Castro to create chaos. Well, the assassination part of it fell apart. Northwoods is a CIA plan to actually attack U.S. assets and try to make it look like it was done by Castro as a provocation for a war. This gives you some idea how upset the military-industrial complex was with John Kennedy after the Cuban Missile Crisis and after the failure of the Bay of Pigs. Why is Lansdale on the ground on November 22nd, 1963? Isn't that funny that John Kennedy's former Vietnam strategist is on the ground? So the government complicity in the Kennedy assassination has never been fully exposed, although two committees, both the House Assassinations Committee and the Senate Church Committee, specifically the subcommittee chaired by Senator Richard Schweiker, a longtime friend of mine, basically uncovers the CIA's fingerprints all over the Kennedy assassination. Another question. Yes, sir. The question is George H.W. Bush's role on November 22nd. Here's what I do know. Several things. First of all, for 30 years, he says he can't remember where he is. That is, of course, ludicrous. Every adult knows where he was. Then in 1987, two very troubling documents are declassified by the American government. One is a memo from J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director, written just after the assassination, that says that he wants the FBI to look into right-wing Cuban activity in the Dallas area and be sure to brief George Bush of the CIA on their activities. When a Texas reporter reads this, he goes to CIA and he wants the personnel records for this George Bush. At first, the agency says that George Bush never worked here. Then they change their story and say, oh, there was a George Bush, but he was only here briefly. He was detailed over from the GSA. But we can't find him. We've lost touch with him. Well, this reporter finds him very easily in the Washington phone book. He's listed. He calls the guy up and he says, are you George Bush? Yes. You're not George H.W. Bush. No. Did you work at the CIA? He said, well, it was the weirdest thing. They sent me over there for a couple months. They gave me nothing to do. And then they sent me back to GSA. So they created this George Bush as a cover. Fletcher Prouty, on whom Oliver Stone, who is not my uncle, on which his book is based, claims that he, as a CIA operative, turned boats over for the Bay of Pigs of invasion to an operative named George W. Bush, and that the code name of that operation was Zapata, the name of Bush's faux oil company. Zapata never makes a profit. In fact, he doesn't try very hard to make a profit. Why? Because it's a Central Intelligence Agency front. Russ Baker's book on this is particularly good, Family of Secrets. So for those who say to me, why don't you expose George Bush's role? Well, we don't know what it is. Here, all we know is that he's dissembled for some good reason. I am currently looking into the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan because we haven't been told the truth about that. No one has ever told us that Hinckley's father is a CIA operative in the oil business, is a partner with George H.W. Bush. And that there's a photo of a man at Robert Kennedy's assassination who looks amazingly like Mr. Hinckley, who goes by the name of Hinckley. So, and the one time that Newsweek magazine gets in to see John Hinckley in prison, the one time he's given an interview, he says, there were others involved in the plot, I didn't act alone, and then he is silenced. No, I think the Bushes tried to take Reagan out in a coup d'etat the way Nixon was taken out in a coup d'etat, the way Kennedy was taken out in a coup d'etat. George Bush had no confidence in his ability to win an election. He's lost every big election he's ever been in. He lost two U.S. Senate races in Texas. He lost the 1980 election. I worked against him very actively when he ran for president in 1980. I was handling the Northeastern states. You know what I saw in his campaign? Spooks, CIA operatives that were retired, just like E. Howard Hunt was retired, but he wasn't. He was still on the agency payroll. Four of the Watergate burglars, of the four Watergate burglars with CIA ties, two of them are still on the payroll and reporting to case officers. The Central Intelligence Agency infiltrates and sabotages the Watergate break-in. E. Howard Hunt, This guy's an experienced spook. He helped take down the Guatemalan government for the CIA. He's an experienced CIA agent. He's in the Howard Johnson's lookout post across from the Watergate. When the burglars are arrested, he flees. Why would he leave a laundry slip on the desk with his name, address, and phone number on it unless he wanted to be caught? So the entire Bush involvement in Watergate is even more interesting. The Watergate burglars are arrested with an enormous amount of cash on them in $1,000 bills. Those bills are traced to a Mexican bank. Then they are traced to Texans who are friends of and the fundraisers for George H.W. Bush. Let me put it another way. George Bush financed the Watergate break-in, and the money was laundered through Mexico. When I finish with the Clintons, I will write my book. It's tentatively called The Bush Crime Family. Ross Perot told me in an interview that in the 1980s, he became obsessed with the idea that we had prisoners of war that were left behind, and the government was doing nothing about it. He badgered the government, and they would do nothing about it. So he went out spending his own money, hired soldiers of fortune to scout around Asia and see if he could find prisoners of war. And what he found was the Central Intelligence Agency running enormous amounts of drugs. Why? I'll tell you why. One, drugs are very profitable. Two, when you're the government, you can't get busted because you're the cops. And three, you can put your competitors out of business. You can put them in jail. Perot was so distraught that he said, I will go to my friend and fellow Texan Vice President George Bush and tell him what I've learned. And he gets a meeting with Bush and he says, you're not going to believe this. I have learned that the Central Intelligence Agency is running enormous amounts of heroin out of Asia. He said Bush merely looked at him with a grim smile. The greatest drug running at the Central Intelligence Agency happens when Bush is the director. He's running most of those drugs through Arkansas with the willful knowledge and cooperation of his close friend and fellow CIA alum, William Jefferson Clinton, who Cord Meyer tells us was recruited at Oxford. So there's a whole storyline there that needs to be explored. Yes, sir, in the back.
Yeah, I have two questions about Bobby Kennedy.
Yes.
I hinted at this, but was there any connection to his assassination and his brother's assassination? And the other one is, do you think that Bobby could have beaten Nixon if he was assassinated?
Okay, let me take those. I'll take them seriatim. First of all, I think that there is substantial evidence that those who killed John Kennedy also killed Robert Kennedy. The question is Robert Kennedy, are the Kennedy assassinations connected, and would Kennedy have defeated Nixon in 1968? Several things are true. Just the other day, Frank Mankiewicz died, who was Robert Kennedy's press secretary and a very good friend of mine, a true gentleman, a real professional. And in the closing days of the 1968 primary, Robert Kennedy was asked in the morning at a student event days before the California primary about the Warren Commission, and he gave very weak support for the Warren Commission. But that afternoon, in another student town hall meeting, a student said, you know, will you reopen the Warren Commission investigation and release all the records? And he said, to Mankiewicz's shock, yes. 2 days later, he was dead. Dr. Martin Luther King was talking on the phone with a high-level Southern Christian Leadership Conference colleague, and we know for a certainty that that phone call was wiretapped by Edgar Hoover, and he said, I'm going to endorse Bob Kennedy. He's my main man. 2 days later, he was dead. Yeah, I think they're connected events. The government has not ever explained any of the discrepancies in the botched L.A. Police Department murder of Robert Kennedy. Now, we do know that Lyndon Johnson, that when Kennedy was shot, Robert Kennedy was shot, and he was still alive in the hospital, his top aide, Pierre Salinger, and his brother-in-law, Stephen Smith, called Vice President Humphrey and said, there is a brain surgeon in Dallas who we think could save Bob's life. Could you dispatch a military plane to bring him to Los Angeles immediately? And Humphrey said, of course. So he called the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who ordered the plane. The plane was on its way to Boston when Lyndon Johnson heard it about it. He canceled the plane. He called Humphrey and he said, you had no right to order that. You don't have the authority. Whereupon Kennedy Johnson called the hospital in Los Angeles, called the president of the hospital, the doctor who ran the hospital, who tried to say, "Yes, Mr. President," and Johnson yelled at the top of his lungs, "Is he dead yet? Is he dead yet?" A monster. Robert Kennedy called him a monster. Richard Nixon called him a monster. They both called him an animal. I think that sums it up. As for your second question, no, I don't think so. I realize it's an article of faith among liberals that had Robert Kennedy lived, but here's the problem. He couldn't carry any southern state, nor could he carry any border state. The Robert Kennedy that we revere today, and there are qualities there that I admire, went to Joe McCarthy's funeral and never threw him over the side, also made Kennedy in his lifetime an extremely polarizing and unpopular figure. He was besieged by the left. Challenge Johnson. Please challenge Johnson. End the war. Challenge Johnson. He says no. Senator Eugene McCarthy, who is certainly no Robert Kennedy in terms of talent, challenges Johnson. He nicks Johnson badly in the New Hampshire primary. This is why Johnson doesn't run. He can't win again. That's why he doesn't run. He realizes it's over. But that doesn't mean he's ready to let Bobby be president. Not a chance. And therefore, even if Bobby lived, remember that in 1968, most of the delegates are not selected in primaries. They're controlled by the bosses. And the bosses are controlled by the man who gives them federal dollars, Lyndon Johnson. He owned that convention. He would have delivered for Humphrey, in my opinion. But even if I'm wrong, even if Mayor Daley had switched to Bobby, which there's no evidence that he would have, but if he had and Kennedy had been elected, I can't count 270 electoral votes. Here is the truth. Nixon wanted to run against Bobby because he knew Bobby couldn't carry any of the Deep South. Remember, Nixon lost Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Texas, all to John Kennedy. He would have carried all of those against Bobby, so I don't think so. But it would have been a great contrast to the new and the old. And Bobby Kennedy, many liberals were furious at him for the obvious opportunism of getting in only after the big fight was over and McCarthy had already wounded Kennedy. McCarthy would have supported Humphrey over Bobby. And he would not have endorsed Bobby for the general election. He would have sat it out. So Bobby would have had problems on his left and his right. I think that's significant also. Another question. Let's see if we have any. Yes, sir.
Yes. Nixon's escalation of the war on drugs.
Yes.
I guess commonly accepted that it was to get rid of the hippie protesters out in front of the White House. Were there alternative reasons for that?
The question is about the war on drugs, which I would have to chalk up as Nixon's one of his single greatest failures. The war on drugs has been an ignominious, ineffective, expensive failure. Ironically, I think it is just – I think it is based not as much in political calculation as in outdated thinking about how to battle the scourge of drugs that favors incarceration over treatment. Now, did it have political appeal for middle America? Yeah, they were scared to death about a drug epidemic in America. If you had to chalk up Nixon's greatest mistakes, you've certainly got taking us off the gold standard, closing the gold window. The economy still has volatility today because of that, in my opinion. The wage and price controls, probably his other greatest error. And then lastly, the war on drugs. There is evidence of a government study that is done at NIH while Nixon's president that says that marijuana may have some positive qualities, and it is suppressed. It's not clear that it ever gets to Nixon's level.
I think he dismissed it before it was released.
I think that there is some evidence that Bob Finch and his people may have dismissed it before it was released. Yes. So it would, in any balanced appraisal of Nixon, the war on drugs has to be among his greater failures. The war on cancer, on the other hand, is miraculously successful in terms of the advances made under the funding for cancer treatment. So, again, one must take the good with the bad and try to see the entire record. Another question. This will be our last one, and then I would be happy to sign either one of these fine books. They make great Christmas presents. You can go to stonezone.com. Also, if you're interested, we have these very special T-shirts that say, "You don't know Dick." And you can go to stone@stonezone.com, and we can make these available to you as well. I thank you again for coming. Last question. Yes, sir.
Nixon painted this really
Yes.
Was he a real major force in that? I wouldn't be surprised.
First of all, Helms is Lyndon Johnson's man. And I think Howard Baker put it best when he, Senator Howard Baker, when he said Nixon and Helms had so much on each other that neither could breathe. Nixon and Helms are associated in the failed mafia CIA plots to kill Castro, which morphs into the Bay of Pigs invasion. So they're wedded to each other. Nixon doesn't trust Helms. And as Bob Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff, tells us in his memoir, from the day he got there, Nixon starts demanding the records of the Kennedy assassination. Why? Because he knows that that's the leverage he needs on the agency. Little does he know that Helms has already destroyed those records. There's nothing to hand over. He never trusts Helms. In fact, he packs him off to be the Iranian ambassador to get rid of him post-Watergate. But by then, the Central Intelligence Agency sends a man to Howard James McCord's home to destroy all of his records of Watergate the day after he's arrested. They're burned in his fireplace. The Central Intelligence Agency fingerprints are all over Watergate. In the Senate Watergate Committee report, there's a subcommittee report by Howard Baker and Fred Thompson, who's now a pitchman for reverse mortgages and a former senator, in which they had 13 different proof of the Central Intelligence Agency's involvement in Watergate. Why would James McCord, an experienced spy, put the tape on the garage doors this way instead of this way? Unless, of course, he wanted to get caught. Anyway, thank you very much for coming. I'd be happy to sign books for you. Come on up.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.